All right, so what I want to talk about is what's usually called the cyclic Deligne conjecture. So some part of it is a, well, at this point, relatively old story about two-dimensional topological quantum field theories. But even before that, let me remind you maybe, what is the Deligne conjecture and what's the connection to two-dimensional topological quantum field theories? So the Deligne conjecture, says the following, that if C is a category, so for me, all categories will be something like DG category, but this is not exactly what Deligne conjectured. He conjectured this for algebras, but no matter, then the Hochschild cochains which I'll denote HH of C. I don't like using HC because that stands for cyclic homology, cyclic chains. So has a natural structure. Of what's called an E2 algebra. So this was what Deligne conjectured. It was based on work of Gerstenhaber that showed that the cohomology groups have the structure of a Gerstenhaber algebra, that there's a shifted Lie bracket, and Deligne asked whether this lifts to the chain level, and then that structure is the homology of the little disk, two disks operad, and so. Well, this is a theorem many times. From the modern point of view, this is essentially a triviality, which is that, so you use the fact that E2 algebras, this is the same thing as there's something called additivity of E1 algebras and E1 algebras, and Hochschild. So let me put a star here to distinguish Hochschild cochains from Hochschild chains. This is endomorphisms of the unit inside of a monoidal category, which is endomorphisms of C. So you have a monoidal category, you have the unit, and so endomorphisms of the unit will have two compatible associative algebra structures, one coming from the tensor product in the category and one coming from the fact that it's endomorphisms of something composition. That's composition. So it has two compatible. E1 associative algebra structures. So this is essentially a triviality from this point of view, as long as you, well, have this machinery set up to be able to talk about this, and you have this additivity theorem. So there's a kind of an enhancement of this. Is, I guess, some version of the cyclic Deligne conjecture. Is that if C has a Calabi-Yau structure, let me be a little bit vague about that, then Hochschild cochains is actually a frame, is what's called a framed E2 algebra. Anyway, which is, from many points of view, very unfortunate terminology, but we're stuck with it. And so this is also, in various forms, various versions of this has been proven by various people. Yeah?
Unfortunately, so fact is that the one on the left is a framed topological theory.
Correct. Yes, that's right. So precisely. So here, this gives you a frame topological quantum field theory, whereas this one is giving you an oriented two-dimensional TFT. And so anyway, some version of this has been proven by lots of people. So the best version is due to Kevin, I think, which is that C gives 2D an extended to D T Q of T oriented. T with call it Z, with Z of a circle identified with Hochschild cohomology. So the point is that like this framed E2 algebra structure, from this point of view, the framed E2 algebra structure this is the genus zero operations. Seen this before. If you don't know what a framed E2 algebra structure, well, you can take this as the definition that it's the genus zero operation in an oriented 2D TQFT. Yes. So there are two versions. There's a kind of a proper version and a smooth version. The proper version is maybe most familiar, is where you have a cyclic pairing on Hom spaces. I guess strictly speaking, Kevin proved this for proper Calabi-Yau's, although there's no meaningful difference. I mean, you can just apply two opposite on the target and run the same argument.
If you say so.
Thought about this at some point. Maybe I'll put Jacob's name also. Some version of this. Jacob gave another proof of this kind of statement and kind of gave a slightly more conceptual formulation.
It's like an oriented discussion that just happened. My memory is Kevin's thing is
Yeah, that's right.
This difference in the different quality of structures, exactly which those benefits are
about? Sorry, for smooth versus proper?
Yeah.
So let me phrase it in terms of more in Lurie terms than Costello terms. It's like you have a two-dimensional TQFT that's extended, but there's a restriction. You have to have either incoming boundary or outgoing boundary, depending on whether your thing is smooth or proper. So for a proper thing, you have to have incoming boundary, and for smooth thing, you have to have outgoing boundary. So in the proper case, you have the pairing, and in the smooth case, you have like the co-pairing.
It's a measure.
Right. Exactly. So this has some. So you might say, okay, well, maybe a framed E2 algebra structure is, well, how much better is it than having an E2 algebra structure? And for many cases, it's a lot better. Note, here's kind of at least for my purposes, a really important consequence of having a framed E2 algebra structure rather than just an E2 algebra structure is, so if A is a framed E2 algebra, then I can take the circle, so it automatically has a circle action on it, which is something that general E2 algebras don't, and I can take the co-invariance with respect to the circle action and shift shift by plus one. This has a structure of a Lie algebra. So this is due to, I guess in this formulation, this is due to a Craig Westerlund. So in fact, it has more. It has a gravity, what's called a gravity algebra structure.
This is related to cyclic cohomology.
Yes. So in the case of Hochschild cohomology, this will be so in that example, this will exactly be the cyclic cohomology. Exactly. And so this is for many purposes, this is like the key thing you extract, at least for me, from having a framed D2 algebra structure, is like this Lie algebra structure. It has more structure. So in fact, it's a gravity algebra.
There's another Lie algebra structure.
It's not that. No, this is. No, it's not that. It's because it's co-invariance and there's a shift. It's like it comes from a transgression. Basically, you can trivialize the multiplication. Anyway, it looks kind of like a secondary operation. In fact, it's a gravity algebra. I don't want to get into what that means, but that's something a little bit more than a Lie algebra. And so, as an example, a key example to keep in mind is if M is a closed oriented D-dimensional manifold, so you take C to be, well, let me say it like this, locally constant sheaves on M, the appropriately derived category of locally constant sheaves on M, constant sheaves on M, if this formulation is, so this is the same as modules over the based loop space, over chains on the based loop space, maybe that's more familiar. So then H is C, this is the homology of the free loop space shifted by D, if I'm not mistaken. What's that? By plus or minus D, I think it's, I think I, I think, yeah. No, sorry, it's minus D. Shifted by minus D, and so this has a, this whole structure, the orientation gives you a Calabi-Yau structure, and this whole structure is part of the framed E2 algebra structure is what's called string topology in this case, and the Lie bracket on, in this case, the cyclic homology. There's an induced Lie bracket on the equivariant homology. So this is called the string bracket. I don't know, the Chass-Sullivan string bracket. What's that?
Well, to help you unpack the answer to the question from Theo. So each Hochschild homology would have an infinite structure with some bracket.
Yes.
And this is not the algebra.
This is not that. So, no, this is some descendant operation.
So in this case, right, before I took equivariance, we have two circles and together.
Yeah.
So that's a familiar thing. But now we're taking the quotient, so they're on parameterized circles?
Yeah.
S1 of ways of putting them together, we're averaging over that.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So one L infinity bracket. Anyway, no, it's.
Maybe it's a double integral. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. No. But it's not the naive one. This is the point. Like this. Just to.
My
maybe just to give an example of what this gives, is I can give an example, and then maybe I don't know if this would be helpful. If M is a surface, if M is a Riemann surface, M is a Riemann surface, then this guy, then the Lie algebra is the what is it called? Goldman Lie algebra. Oh, sorry, is that a familiar thing? So it's generated by free loops on the surface, and the bracket is of two things is you concatenate at intersection points. Yeah. Yes, exactly. So it gives you this one, which is different from the this is kind of the interesting one. This is ultimately at least for me, this kind of Lie algebra is the most interesting part of the structure of this whole business, and part of what we were trying to do was to kind of get at this a little bit more conceptually.
So the twist on log situations, one thing that happens often is that I'm just looking at Hodgkin homology of an algebra.
Uh-huh.
Things like, I don't know, C.
Okay.
And in this case, this becomes...
Yeah, so I mean, the Hochschild homology here with the shift, you know, has some additional structure. Coming from this orientation. So one goal... So let me kind of set myself up for two goals here. So in some sense, well, okay. So there's a nice theory of these things. What more is there to talk about? Well, one goal is like there's a big discrepancy between the left-hand side and the right-hand side of the board here, which is that this kind of ordinary Dillene conjecture was very easy, and this way, well, at least proving this is much harder. However, you prove this fact, I don't know an easy way to. Anyway, this is hard. This is easy and formal, and this is much harder, I think. And so one goal was to get at this in a kind of a more direct way. Some goals. One is to understand the framed E2 algebra structure more directly.
I'm saying something like just to directly authorize rather than more complicated. I mean,
oh, for instance, yeah. I mean, really, I wanted a version of this argument for this case. And two, it turns out that this gives a generalization. I think this is the main thing I want to advertise to where there doesn't seem to be a TQFT. So it's. I think this is the main thing I want to advertise, partly because this feels very strange to me. It seems like this suggests that we're really missing something. That
this means that like, you only have chance zero operations.
No, it means that I can produce a framed E2 algebra structure. So the idea is that, how to think of this? This modern point of view is kind of, this point of view that I said is kind of very algebraic. Rather than thinking about disks or whatever, you just say, well, I know what an associative algebra is, and I know what an associative algebra in associative algebra is, and I can algebraically describe this. This kind of point of view is much more geometric. Like the hard, I mean, in some sense, the hard part of this work that Kevin does and that Jacob does is to relate the algebra to the topology of the situation. And the idea is that we can actually produce framed E2 algebra structures purely algebraically. So by one, I guess I mean to give a more algebraic description of this thing. And by two, we'll see that it applies more generally, and it doesn't look like there's a TQFT. On the other hand, it would be nice if there were something. And anyway, I want to ask that as a question. So
how are we doing?
Okay, great. So the idea is, well, the starting point here is you have this Dunn additivity which decomposes E2 algebras. And so framed E2 algebras are like E2 algebras which are circle equivariant. So you can think of this as kind of choosing. You have note. So E2 algebras, I want to think, well, I will do some geometry for now. These are factorization algebras. So all of my factorization algebras will be locally constant by definition on the plane. And so this description of E1 and E1 algebras, so Dunn additivity, involves a choice of coordinates. So in particular, framed E2 algebras, I guess I should say, framed E2 algebras, this is S1 equivariant factorization algebras on R2, almost tautologically. I mean, depends on what you take as the definition of framed E2 algebras, but so the point is, this Dunn additivity involves a choice of equivariance, and of course this breaks the S1 symmetry. So it seems like, so you can't literally do that. So what do you do? Well, the idea is to generalize things a little bit and to consider not R squared, but to consider stratified spaces. So the idea is consider factorization algebras on R squared stratified by 0 and R squared minus 0. The advantage is that's nicely compatible with the S1 action. And the idea is that, well, there's a theory of stratified factorization algebras on stratified spaces due to Ayala, Francis, and Tanaka. And the part of the theory says that if you add a stratification, then the unstratified thing embeds fully faithfully into it. So the basic theorem that we prove it's a little bit funny to state it this way, but I think it was at least either expected and or a folk theorem for a while. Let me say it, but I don't think, anyway, but it took some effort to actually prove. So let X be a stratified space in a suitable sense. Space, then there's an equivalence between factorization algebras on the stratified space, which is the cone of X, and E1 algebras in factorization algebras on X times just E1 algebras with, times E1 alg plus mod. Okay, let me explain what these symbols mean and what the the idea is that this, so what do we want to apply it to? So, well, let me just draw a picture. Picture is that if we have a cone on something, we can project to the ray. I think in the physics literature, this is called cigar compactification or something like that. And so, We can take the relative factorization homology. So this gives a functor from factorization algebras on the cone of x. So this is a picture of the cone of x to factorization algebras on this ray. And this category is identified with pairs of an associative algebra, A. And M, and A module. So this category of factorization algebras on the ray, I guess I should have said, part of the how this stratified factorization algebras business works is that this category is this way. And so what this is saying is that...
I'd like to ask you both, like, zero structures of units, so should I ask for...
What's that?
Is this a good time to ask what's going on with these zero structures?
So this is, everything is unital here. That's a great question, and this is really important. Anyway, this is a really subtle point in this whole business. And but the way this, so for this theorem to be true and for, so everything is unital, including,
So by module, you mean?
By module. Yeah, so by module, I mean pointed module, correct, thank you. Yes, because you have an inclusion like this, which gives you a map from A to M, and where the M is where one goes under this inclusion. What's that?
Is it these units quite an issue for a while?
Yes, absolutely. Anyway, so this is kind of the general fact, is that factor is describing kind of algebraically factorization algebras on a cone. So I guess I should.
Let's be a little bit in the module.
Yeah.
I mean, if the cone on X was smooth, I would understand. Like, it was an active natural identity local operator.
Oh, I mean, I think this is saying that there has to be an identity local operator anyway.
Yeah, but it's a singularity. Why would there be a special?
Well, I mean, you take a neighborhood of a cone.
Yes.
Right? And you take a neighborhood a little bit away from a cone. Again, there is that insertion.
Just like there was an insertion.
Just like here. So this is cone on a point, by the way. This is a special case of a cone. This is cone on a point. Did I get that right?
Could have done something else. You could have asked. Sort of only having maps that were surjective on a set of strata that are in the maps.
I could have, but then this statement would be false.
And it's like a wrong thing to do.
Yeah. No. I mean, they're non-unit. Like, I mean, one of the subtleties here is that what you would like, and there doesn't seem to be a good geometric way of handling this, is you'd like for the algebra to be unital, but the module to not be.
Yes.
I'll get to an example of where you'd want this in a second. But there doesn't seem to be a good geometric way to do it. Either, like, the most natural things is either for everything to be unital or everything to be non-unital. And
if I have x in the module, I get the different factorization algebra.
Correct.
But okay,
if it helps. It helps the way it what helps me to, the way it helps me to think about it. Maybe this will not be so helpful for you. Is that if you have like a punctured manifold and I have a sheaf on that and I have a vector space and I want to put it and I want to build a new sheaf, which is the same outside of that point, and where the fiber at the given point is my vector space. There's this kind of extra connecting map, which is the analog of in this case of specifying that unit.
If I had a factorization algebra,
yeah.
Then I could define correlation functions for things in the book.
Yeah.
But of course, with mechanics, I need a stated either end to do that.
Yes.
And that's that state.
Yeah.
Generate a state is relative to that for now.
Right. Yeah. But anyway, indeed, different choices of M would give you different factorization algebras. OK, great. So I want to apply this to this stratified space, 0 inside of R squared, which is the cone in S1. And so what we get, so the upshot, is that factorization algebras on this stratified space, this is equivalent to the following thing. Well, it's an E2 algebra. It's the same as, well, one algebra. So it's like an E2, so in other words, it's an E2 algebra A and a pointed module. Yeah. Module over, so this is E2 algebra, and a pointed module over this guy. So I guess now is a good time, maybe you're about to ask about orientations or framings.
Ask about how the fact that this doesn't impact what you wrote about.
How this does, that's this map.
But you wrote E1 factorization.
Yeah, but I'm using done additivity here.
But
factorization, I'm sorry.
And so you're doing something, you're also sneaking in.
No, I meant this. I just jumped the gun.
Yes. So it's E1 algebra for the algebra for the trace.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so that's that. That's one. But now the point is this description is completely circle equivariant. So now taking circle invariants. I'm doing okay, actually. So taking circle invariance, S1 invariance, we get that factorization algebras on this thing, 0 inside of R squared, circle invariance. This is equivalent to now, I'm going to sneak additivity. So the point is, circle invariant factorization algebras on the circle are just associative algebras. Now this forces the automorphism. So I guess factorization algebras on the circle, what are they? They're associative algebras together with an automorphism. Being circle equivariant forces that automorphism to be trivial. So this is E2 algebras, that's E1 algebras.
What you're saying is that also the circle is somehow acting totally orthogonal to the radial directions.
It's totally orthogonal. So E1 algebras in S1 modules is what I get here. You have to take invariance of everything. But the point is invariance of like on this thing, the S1 action is trivial. So algebras, so equivariant things are just algebras in the equivariant category. With, E1 algebra plus module star in kind of S1 modules. So this gives a very algebraic description of this category. And now we can ask for the condition that inside here, so factorization algebras on R squared, S1, so this is framed E2 algebras. This sits fully faithfully inside here. Yes, exactly. So the The way it sits inside is very simple. So in particular, a factorization algebra on something in particular gives you, well, a sheaf or a co-sheaf on that something. And the essential image here is those which are locally constant. Like the underlying sheaf or co-sheaf is locally constant. And so what we get is the following very algebraic description of, let me state it as a theorem. There's an equivalence between framed E2 algebras, and the following data. A, an E2 algebra, M, a circle module, which is with action of with action of the Hochschild homology in circle modules, together with a cyclically invariant vector. So far this is just describing this category, and now I have to also ask to lie in the essential image of this, so such that the composite from A goes to Hochschild homology of A, and this goes to M, which is capping with this class M, is an equivalence. So this, okay, it's a little bit of a mouthful, but the point is it's a purely algebraic description of what a framed E2 algebra is. And now I can use Dunn additivity, exactly, to produce examples like this. So now, let me kind of right away prove the cyclic Deligne conjecture in the form that I stated, sort of not the relative one. And then I'll say, and in the remaining time, I'll say something about the relative case. So suppose, so the idea is the Hochschild homology and cohomology invariants, they're going to very naturally give me this. So suppose C is a DG category, so a Calabi-Yau structure, smooth. So there's a dual picture for smooth DG category. So the example I gave earlier about modules for chains on the base loop space is an example of such. I'll give some more examples later. So a Calabi-Yau structure is actually, let me not say what a comma, maybe let me say it like this, an orientation of C of dimension D is a class theta, this Calabi-Yau class in Hochschild homology minus D. Which induces is non-degenerate. I jumped the gun a little bit, so let me say what non-degenerate means. What I mean by non-degenerate, well, the thing is, even if I forget, if I just take this guy, not factorization algebras on the plane, but the stratified version. That looks like something, that looks almost like something you get just out of a category without any additional structure, which is this non-commutative calculus. So let me remind you first how this works, and I'll use this to say what non-degenerate means, and we'll deduce. So non-commutative calculus is the following kind of thing. So if you have just kind of almost an arbitrary DG category, so the strictly you need dualizable in order for this to make sense, well, then there are kind of two basic Hochschild invariants. You can look at Hochschild cochains, and you could look at Hochschild chains. So Hochschild cochains is a kind of fancy automorphisms of this category. So you expect that it acts on all sorts of other invariants associated to the category, in particular Hochschild homology. And the way they're related is via this thing called the non-commutative calculus, and there are a couple of ways of saying it. One is that this pair is an algebra over what's called the Kontsevich-Soybelman operad, also sometimes called disks and cylinders. So I don't want to say too much about this particular operad other than it's essentially, it's almost that one. So it would be exactly that if you don't ask the module to have a unit. It's like exactly what you would get from factorization algebras on the stratified R squared, where in the module you don't ask for a unit. That's what this would be. Unfortunately, the theory is such that there's no kind of good way of saying that, because as I was saying, it's hard to. So here is really an instance where you want to impose the algebra to have a unit, but the module not to. But no, it doesn't. If it was an algebra, it would.
It's an algebra.
But you need to choose an object. You want to choose an object and take its trace, right? That would work, but I want to work Morita invariantly. I don't know. Part of one consequence of, like, well, there's various literature on this kind of subject. A lot of it is written in the language of algebras and with explicit formulas, and oftentimes a question crops up is it Morita invariant? And the answer is always yes, and this is a way of formulating things so that everything is manifestly Morita invariant. But anyway, so this is equivalent to saying the following thing, is that Hochschild homology is a circle module, and is a left module over the algebra in S1 modules, which is given by the Hochschild homology of Hochschild cohomology. Let's see. This is another description of what calculus gives you. So non-commutative calculus, I guess, is a non-commutative version of the theory of the most non-trivial part of all of this that you get out of this is a version of Cartan's magic formula in this case. So you should think of Hochschild cohomology is some non-commutative version of vector fields. Hochschild homology is some non-commutative version of differential forms. I mean, literally by the HKR isomorphism. In kind of geometric examples, that's what you get. And there are other good analogies. And this is supposed to be encoding. So in like differential geometry, the way vector fields act on differential forms is, well, you have kind of the action, and you have the most non-trivially, you have Cartan's magic formula. And this is kind of encoding a non-commutative version of Cartan's magic formula. I guess to elaborate on that would be a subject of a different talk, but I'm happy to explain in more detail afterwards. But anyway, so this looks very similar to to what we want. And so so this is the calculus structure. So this looks similar. So the idea is we can produce exactly that. So if we have a class like this, and non-degenerate will mean so theta in this guy, 1 shifted by minus d is non-degenerate if the composite from Hochschild cohomology to Hochschild homology of Hochschild cohomology to Hochschild homology with a shift by minus d, which is acting on this class, is an equivalence. So that's not exactly the same as having a, that's not exactly the same, this condition, as a Calabi-Yau structure. At least a priori, it's a little bit weaker than having a Calabi-Yau structure.
It's not treating it like an actual affine variety, this is literally saying.
This is, so I think for an affine variety, this is okay. In general, I'm not sure, so in general, being a Calabi-Yau structure is having this kind of equivalence at the level of bimodules. And at least a priori, it appears to be a little bit stronger. Anyway, I can believe, I'm not sure. It's possible that this is just equivalent, but at least a priori, this looks a little bit weaker. But this is the upshot. And so, well, I just plug it into this description. This pair of Hochschild cohomology and shifted Hochschild homology just literally fits. Is, yeah. Well, I mean, it is just what?
So smoothing out the conflict.
Yes, that's right. That is what it's doing, precisely.
Of course, the choice of smoothing the conflict is going to depend on that choice of vacuum vector in the conflict. Even if you didn't have that, once it's smoothed, it has one.
Yeah. Right, yes. Yes, exactly. And, you know, I mean, what's nice is that it matches up exactly the algebraic data with what you need for the thing. So now, at what point am I supposed to stop? What's the usual?
I mean, I think going till 12 is fine.
Okay, is that all right? Okay, great. So that's goal number one achieved. I should say. I guess I should say that, for instance, so I phrased it this way, but the argument works much more generally. Like, there's nothing specific about categories. You can take, like, nonlinear things, too. So, for instance, I think, although I haven't checked this carefully, like this works for when your thing is, like, algebras and DG categories. So I think it should give you, for instance, an infinity categorical enhancement of the fact that the Drinfeld center of a pivotal monoidal category is a, what is that called, a balanced braided monoidal category. I'm phrasing it this way for concreteness, but the argument proves something more general. Should say. So you can take their various, so it's sort of very insensitive to what kind of things you're considering. So I wanted to talk about relative orientations. Yep.
Since you're so upsetting, you can watch out on things like, where did smoothness appear?
Smooth. Yeah.
Actually, no,
I didn't need that.
Okay.
I didn't need that. Sorry. I intended to say I intended to give a definition of what a Calabi-Yau structure is. And for that, I needed smoothness, because I wanted to talk about the inverse dualizing bimodule. But phrased this way, I don't need that. I mean, I don't know. Somehow, the only examples of these kinds of things I know, like in categories, are things that come from smooth Calabi-Yau structures. But yeah, that's the other thing. This makes sense without asking for the category to be smooth, unlike the Calabi-Yau structure.
Like very highly nonlinear things, so
there were
never
smooth. Oh, no, sure. I mean, sure it is. It's like an extra 1.5 dualizable. So smooth means that the evaluation map has a left adjoint. So, like, for instance, a rigid monoidal category will be 2 dualizable in the Morita category. So it will be both smooth and proper in that sense. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm just saying, like, if I wanted to work on, like, if C was totally badly nonlinear objects, I'm not sure I would expect it to be smooth.
Oh, well, I don't know. I mean, you need some dualizability. I mean, like, for Hochschild homology to make sense, you need it to be a dualizable object. So Hochschild homology more abstractly means categorical trace of the... and so for that to make sense, you need it to be dualizable. And so, you know, being smooth is like being a little bit, it's a little bit more than being dualizable. So it's not, I mean, if you have some if it's meaningful to ask for dualizable objects, it's often meaningful to ask about like 1.5 or 2 dualizable objects. Like, you know, another example of a nonlinear situation is some kind of spans. And there you often get that. I think like the Calabi-Yau ones are like the ones that are like cyclic two Siegel objects, which is kind of a cool characterization. But anyway, so suppose I have a functor from C to D of DG categories. What is maybe as so of course this induces a okay, now I have to, well, let me not be very careful. So under good circumstances, depending on my setup, which I was vague about, this induces a map on Hochschild homology. So that's always the case. Hochschild cohomology, on the other hand, is not at all functorial. So it makes sense. So relative Hochschild homology is just the cone on the map, on the induced maps of between Hochschild homologies. But you can define something called the Hochschild cohomology of the map anyway. And what this is the following. You can look at the kind of its endomorphisms of the unit in the endomorphism category of C to D. So it endomorphisms of F, sure. So you can look at the category, endomorphisms of F is the category where objects are like this, and well, morphism, I hope it's clear what category this is. This is obviously a monoidal category. Compose, take the unit, take endomorphisms of the unit. So you can take relative Hochschild cohomology. This is what I will mean by relative Hochschild cohomology. So there's a map. From this, there's an obvious map from this to Hochschild cohomology of C. So there are E2 maps. Just from this Hochschild cohomology to Hochschild cohomology of C and to Hochschild cohomology of D. Just because this category here is a monoidal category, which maps to endomorphisms of C and endomorphisms of D. These are just by transfer of structure. And the point is, I can interpret So calculus in this setting says that if I look at the map on Hochschild homologies from C into Hochschild homology of D, this is a map of, I don't know, S1 modules with an action, compatible action. Of this relative Hochschild homology. Just anyway, for the same reason. I guess I didn't explain how you get this structure, but it's sort of formal nonsense from this definition. It's because let me say it here, how you get this structure, is it comes from the fact that if you look at Hochschild cohomology, that's an E2 algebra, and modules over that, by definition, maps into endomorphisms of C, that's a monoidal functor, and so it acts on your original C, and then you just take Hochschild homology of everything. So you do the same thing here. So a relative orientation, is a class in kind of the relative Hochschild homology, minus D, which is non-degenerate. So let me just say what you get in this setting. So what you get is a fiber sequence of framed E2 algebras, which looks like this. So the Hochschild homology of the target shifted by let me put in some shifts because there's a minus D Hochschild homology of F shifted by minus D to Hochschild homology of C with a shift of 1 minus D. So anyway, in good cases, this the boundary map will induce part of what I mean by non-degenerate here is that the boundary map induces an orientation in the previous sense on the thing. So the point is I have a map like this of honest framed E2 algebras. But this guy will be a non-unital because it's a fiber of a map of prime E2 algebras. And anyway, so let me just say what this gives in an example. Sorry, I wanted to describe more examples. But so if M is a manifold with boundary, what we get is that, for instance, the homology of the free loop space of M just by itself has a non-unital E2 algebra structure. That's this guy. E2 framed E2 algebra structure. And this guy, Lm relative to L, the boundary of M, has a framed E2 algebra structure. The other one is not so interesting. That's just loop space on the boundary. That was the previous example. So the point is, these don't seem to come, as far as I can tell, these don't seem to come from some kind of a TQFT. I guess this is particularly particularly this one. This one seems kind of mysterious. So for this one, there is a kind of answer. So there's a related work of Kentsevich, Takeda, and Vlasopoulos, which construct a kind of, on these things called pre-Calabi-Yau structures, which I don't have time to say anything about, which constructs a kind of 2D TQFT structure on this guy where, I shouldn't have put this one here. Where you have you're required to have both incoming and outgoing boundary. So for this one, I don't know. It's totally not clear to me, for instance, if that forms. In this example, almost certainly it should. But anyway, I don't know of any general framework that explains these kinds of topological quantum field theories. I guess the conjecture would be that all of these examples have this additional structure. But I don't know how to see that. OK. Stop here.
All right, any questions?
Yeah.
At the beginning, you said that the shift, the minus one shifted Hochschild homology has a Lie algebra structure.
Oh, yeah, one shifted, yeah. Hochschild cohomology, yes.
You said you can reframe this Fram E2 algebra structure into this. How do you see that? Shifted the algebra structure.
Oh, sorry, that's just a statement about algebra, framed E2 algebras. So it's kind of a relatively straightforward thing one can do. It's not, sorry, I won't be able to draw you a picture or anything of this thing. But anyway, there's a paper of, so where this is done is there's a paper of Craig Westerlund where he explains how to do that. I mean, you know, there's a general thing that, like if you have an, there's a general thing that he studies that if you have an equivariant operad and you have a kind of an equivariant algebra and you take co-invariance for the group action, what kind of algebra structure descends on this thing? And there's kind of a general operadic machine that lets you answer this question that he builds. And here, what you get here is the gravity, exactly the gravity operad, of which the Lie operad is a part of. So it's kind of a purely operads kind of statement.
I haven't understood the statement that the frame into chart, which does not look like a TQFT.
Well, it's, the question is whether, of course, it gives you all the genus zero operations.
Yes.
The question is, does it extend to give you higher genus operations? So there are two kind of questions. One is this, and two, one should reasonably guess that it does, and two, it's like a purely closed 2D TQFT. I guess the question is whether there is some kind of an open, you know, whether it can be extended also to an open closed. I mean, like even in this case, for a manifold with boundary, I don't know the answer to that. Like what those guys do is construct a purely closed, you know, kind of a this with, where you require incoming and outgoing boundary that's only closed string 2D TQFT. And you know, for instance, one can ask, does it? I mean, you know, all of these classification results, it's really essential that you look at fully extended things. Like you can ask, for instance, you can ask the following question is like how to classify 1-2 dimensional TQFTs. And this doesn't, there, as far as I understand, it's not a finite type question. Like there's not finitely many, there's like infinitely many generators and relations that you need to describe it. Whereas a fully extended one, well, it's very easy.
So you wouldn't like the situation where you can only attach things to 2 points instead of one.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
So 2-1-0 mean that you can attach things to points?
Yes, that's right.
You're not being able to attach things to a pair of points.
Oh, no, pair of points is, I guess, I don't know, maybe that's okay.
Having interfaces.
Oh. I'm not sure. I mean, I don't know if this even has that kind of structure. But
yeah. Knowing one module for this thing.
Right.
Built in the construction.
Right. Well, but Well, no. I mean, what I'd really like is that there's a kind of a classification result, and you plug in an object, and you get this whole structure. And like for just closed 2D TQFTs, it's known that that's kind of hopeless. And I mean, that's one of the advantages of extending down. And so I don't know. It would be nice if this, if these algebras fit into some story where you have also higher genus operations, and it comes from some easy, some classification, finite array classification result.
A fund of categories is really difficult to.
Yes.
Analyze it.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. I think. Yeah. I mean, I think that's exactly the issue.
It's an interface in a fund, right?
Right. But this is not. It's playing a different role here. I mean, it's very tempting to say that it's like a relative field theory or something like that. Well, I think interface is another word for the same thing. But it seems to be doing something completely different.
Especially, you're seeing something tempting to guess that maybe there was a third dimension.
Yeah.
Types of things that produce a group sound is if they have to say n targets with an ordinary single model and I have to fend down a dimension.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
What's the simplest example you want?
What's the simplest example that I would want? Oh, of this kind of thing? I don't know if it's the simplest example, but it's one. So I'll take that as an opportunity to give the example where. So here is a kind of a thing with a relative orientation that's purely algebraic. So take a quiver. Take the doubled quiver. So let's call S the set of vertices. So this has this element M. This famous element. And so I can take this algebra. So this is just a direct sum of polynomial algebras, one for every vertex. So there's a map of algebras from here into the path algebra of this doubled quiver. And this has a relative orientation of dimension 2. So that's a kind of an easy calculation. So in particular, so this means a couple of things. One is that you get this kind of E2 algebra structure on here. So you can, in particular, you get on HC0, because of the shifts, on HC0, you get a Lie algebra structure. That Lie algebra structure is the necklace Lie algebra. It's interesting because, well, for me, this is interesting because it acts on moduli spaces that you can build out of these like this. So this explains this Hamiltonian action. So from this kind of simple-minded thing, you can deduce a Hamiltonian action of the necklace Lie algebra on Nakajima quiver varieties. What's that? Yeah. Well, yeah. Yes. And so, well, I don't know. It's interesting. I don't know. So. Oh yeah. Sorry. So. I mean, for a concrete example, I would propose this one, which seems, you know, probably the easiest to analyze physically.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Thanks very much.